real, I kind of am more Ben, where I think Ben was. I think the real...
I call it...
And with what we're doing. To me, the rate
regulation... Thank you. I call the House Committee on Healthcare to order and open up a public hearing. First public hearing on HJR 12. We'll take testimony from one of our colleagues, Representative Gelser, and then we'll close the public, we'll leave it open, but we'll come back later to have any other in a work session. So, Representative Gelser, will you begin, please?
Good morning, Representative Brewer.
Good morning.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, I am Sarah Gelser, and I represent House District 16. Last year, I was contacted by Dr. Abigail Haberman, who is a dermatologist in my district. She expressed her concerns about the prevalence of skin cancer that she sees in her practice, particularly among young women who had previously used indoor tanning facilities. Dr. Haberman asked me to sponsor HJR 12 on her behalf to encourage Oregonians to be aware of the risks of indoor tanning. I was pleased to do so. Unfortunately, she is unable to be here today to share with you personally the medical risks associated with indoor tanning. But I can tell you that in 2008, an estimated 1,000 Oregonians were diagnosed with skin cancer. In addition, the Center for Disease Control has identified Oregon in the top tier for skin cancer incidence. Dr. Haberman has surmised that indoor tanning bed use among young women is contributing to the rise in melanoma in Oregon. Skin cancer is highly preventable. By taking the simple steps of using sunscreen and avoiding indoor tanning facilities, Oregonians can prevent melanoma. Therefore, I urge you to support HJR 12 and call on Oregonians to raise their awareness about skin cancer and the risks associated with indoor tanning. Thank you for consideration. And as a side note, I understand that you're talking about tobacco taxes next, and I'm so disappointed to miss out on that discussion because it's one of my favorite topics.
Are you for them or opposed to them?
I often find it to be a very good idea to tax tobacco products in order to recoup the many costs that tobacco use visits upon our public health system and on the health of young people and adults. So I hope you have a good conversation.
I think we may hear a bit about that before we're done. While you're here, I guess we have a quorum now.
Correct.
I'm going to open a work session on HJR 12 and ask if the committee has any discussion they would like to have on HJR 12, which is basically a proclamation, right?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Only that I wish we had done this 25 to 30 years ago in the state to sort of get the message out better than we have done. So.
And if we can find something to do even stronger than this eventually to help people deal with this in a better way, that would be fine. Is there any other discussion on HJR 12? Can I hear a motion on HJR 12?
I'd like to make a motion, Mr. Chair, that HJR 12 be adopted.
There is a motion before us to adopt HJR 12 and move it to the floor. Is that right, madam?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, we don't need a do we have a recommendation on a resolution?
To be adopted.
To be adopted. A resolution to be adopted. Is there any discussion? Farr, would you please call the roll?
Yes. Representative
Bruin? Aye.
Representative
Cannon? Excused. Excused.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Panamera?
Excused.
Representative
Protek?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Excused.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion passes. We'll move HJR 12 to the floor with a recommendation to adopt. Would you like to carry it?
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we may reopen. We got at least two of our members and maybe more are down with the legislative crud, whatever it is.
I know that these two are on the way. I saw them moving.
Yeah,
so.
I think the other two aren't. And we'll reopen it later and let them vote on this resolution.
Bill's
as well.
Not good.
Yes, Representative.
Yeah, I know Bill's not feeling well. So. Mm.
No, and neither is Representative Cannon, I think. Okay. Let's open up I'll close the public hearing and the work session on HAR 12. I'll open a work session on HB 2351. And I'm opening a work session because this bill was referred to us with a subsequent to House Human Services. It didn't make sense in this case to, since both of our approaches would be relatively the same, it didn't make sense to try and hear it in both. I talked to Representative Tomei, and she's happy to have us turf it. So I'm opening up a work session for the purpose of referring it to, without recommendation, to the House Human Services Committee. And, Mr. Vice Chair, can I have a recommendation?
How about a motion,
Mr. Chair? A motion would be better than a recommendation.
All right, I have one, Mr. Chair.
A motion without recommendation, in fact.
Exactly. Move HB 2351 to the floor without recommendation as
no.
it passes.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm sorry. I'll learn this business another four sessions, maybe.
When you've been at it as long as I have, sir, you'll be there.
Yeah, I'll understand it.
So, to continue, I move HB 2351 to the floor without recommendation as to passage and that the bill be referred to House Human Services Committee by prior reference.
Is there discussion on this motion? All right. Let's get a roll call on this motion. Representative Kenemer, we're acting on HB 2351 simply for the purpose to move it to the Human Services Committee.
Thank
where
you.
Sorry, there'll please. Be... Oh, wait a minute. One more. Representative Dembro, we have a motion before us now to move a bill simply to the Human Services Committee for action there. And that'll give you a chance to hear it in a different forum.
So I should vote no then.
Yes, you might. Then we'll have to hear it here.
I'm sorry. Can I vote still?
We haven't voted.
We haven't voted yet.
Oh. I just want to tell you
them right now.
We're voting. We did pass another. We did pass HGR 12, and I'll open that later for a chance to vote on that. Please.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Excused.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Kopeck?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Excuse.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlich?
Aye. The ayes have it, and the bill is referred to the committee. It's passed on to the floor without recommendation and referred to the Committee on Human Services as with prior reference. All right, now we need to get to business. Where do we go next? I'm going to open a public hearing on HB 2122, and I'd like to call to the witness stand. Dr. Mel Cohn, please. Let me just introduce this bill to the committee. This is the governor's bill for a tobacco tax. It has numbers in it, as I was just reminded by a reporter. My perspective is that this is a blank slate, and that the revenue chair has asked us to hear health issues in it and to make recommendations and maybe put them in the bill or not, to make recommendations on the level of it relative to the effect it has on health. We'll do that and we'll check with them later as to what form they want it. We may act on it at some point, change it, put some numbers in it, or we may simply take the testimony and make recommendations to the Revenue Committee. We'll hear later, but we're a ways from doing that. Today we're taking testimony on the bill. Dr. Cohn.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the acting director of the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. And it's a pleasure to be here today, even on such a beautiful, sunny Friday afternoon.
Yeah, we shut off the lights so you can... so you'll be safe from suntan.
To talk about what's a very, very important issue in public health. Now, I know that revenue is the issue of the day in many ways. Everyone is talking about that in every way in all aspects of our lives. And so part of my goal in talking about tobacco taxes today is to bring some focus to something other than just revenue generation around this, to really make sure that we're all very clear about the substantial public health benefits that could accrue from tobacco taxes. So this is where I want to start. And I think you all will recognize this handsome young actor. I think this is from 1954. Tobacco.
Trust a politician. Everybody knows that.
Tobacco use was an extremely common and glamorous thing to do at that time in our country. And lest you think that I'm just picking on politicians, Mitch, you can see here, doctors were in the act as well. But we really have come a very, very long way. This graph shows per capita cigarette consumption in 1963 on the left, a little over 4,000 cigarettes, to 2006, where we're at about 1,700 cigarettes. And this is a very, very dramatic change. 1963, incidentally, was the year in which tobacco consumption peaked in the United States. But despite that progress, tobacco remains the leading preventable cause of death and disability in the U.S. And in Oregon as well. This graph shows the causes of preventable deaths in Oregon. These are round numbers. You'll see they're estimated. We don't yet have our 2008 numbers in for good. But you can see that compared to the other causes of illness that we often think about, diet and activity patterns, alcohol, toxic agents, microbial agents, which incidentally includes HIV/AIDS, motor vehicles, firearms, sexual behavior, illicit use of drugs, and so forth, tobacco far and away outstrips them. And in fact, tobacco accounts for almost a quarter of all of the deaths that happen in Oregon each year. So the burden of tobacco is huge for us here. And smoking remains common. Many of the causes of death, of course, take many years to develop, but we still have an enormous number of smokers. In 2007, 17% of adults were smokers here, and about 8% of adult men also use smokeless tobacco. In addition, 20 youth start to smoke each day. 9% of 8th graders report that they smoked in the past month, and 16% of 11th graders smoked in the past month. And these numbers are very concerning because kids who start to smoke early have a much more difficult time quitting. And, of course, they also have that much more time for the bad health effects of tobacco to accrue to them. The costs are enormous. The total economic costs in Oregon due to tobacco are estimated at $2.2 billion. It costs the Oregon Health Plan $287 million each year. And one way to look at this, too, particularly when we're talking about tobacco taxes, which, of course, are levied on a pack of cigarettes, is that the cost of a pack of cigarettes at the store is far less than the true cost to all of us. And the retail cost of a pack of cigarettes is roughly around $4.50. You can get them a little cheaper, pay a little bit more from place to place. But the actual cost to society is estimated at more than $11. And this is part of the rationale, I think, for why taxing this, assuming that we use the proceeds to address some of those costs, is a justifiable and appropriate approach. So I mentioned already that tobacco use peaked in 1963. This graph shows tobacco use over the years, starting back at 1900. You can see huge increase during World War II when tobacco was actively promoted for our troops. These guys came home from having been on the battlefield and, of course, were hailed as heroes, and many of them had become addicted to tobacco in the course of being on the battlefields. And so this really brought the problem home in a big way. And then the tide started to turn. You can see in the early 60s, the U.S. Surgeon General's report, I believe that was 1964, the broadcast advertising ban, non-smokers' rights movements beginning. And then, right here, federal cigarette tax doubles. And you can see that the use of tobacco has started to decline pretty dramatically after that. So all of these environmental changes had a huge impact on tobacco use, the tax being a very, very important one of those tools. So this graph shows the price per pack. This is the tobacco tax imposed per pack. The red line is the Oregon cigarette tax, and the blue line is the federal cigarette tax. And again, you can see that the line starting in the 70s really started to increase. I would call your attention to the small decrease that occurred in, I believe it was 2003, when the 10-cent a pack tax on tobacco was allowed to sunset. I believe Oregon may be the only state in the country that has actually decreased tobacco taxes. So that is a distinction that unfortunately we have here. Our current tax is $1.18 a pack. Just to emphasize this point that the tax increases do have an effect on consumption. The pink line here is cigarette sales in millions of packs, and then the blue line is the real cigarette price, and you can see that those two lines basically mirror each other. As the price goes up, consumption goes down. Not really a surprise when you think about how we behave with all kinds of things that we purchase.
Definition of real cigarette price, is there something in real that we need to know about? Is that what people pay on the street? Real, it's just being...
Right. I believe that's an estimate of what's out there, what you would pay if you went into a store to buy a cigarette.
Okay, there are not some other factors loaded in here that... Okay.
No.
All right, thank you.
That's the retail price. So there's been an extraordinary amount of economic research to look at how powerful this price stimulus is. And the bottom line is that a 10% rise in price reduces how many cigarettes are smoked by 4%, reduces how many adults smoke by 2%, because the increase in price is enough to push folks who are thinking about quitting just over into actually doing it.
Mel, is this a 10% rise in the retail price?
Yes.
Okay.
And raises the probability of quit attempts by 10 to 12%. Now, you'll notice that the number of adults who actually quit is only 2%. Obviously, many people try to quit. This is an extraordinarily difficult thing to do, and they are not always successful. But nonetheless, the more often people try, the more often we're going to have successful cessation. And as you can see, raises the probability of quitting successfully by 1 to 2%. So I mentioned already the issue about youth being a particular population that we're very concerned about. And youth are particularly sensitive to price. Perhaps not surprising. Again, they tend not to have a lot of money. So we know that a 10% rise in price reduces the number of cigarettes smoked by youth by 6% as compared with 4% for adults, and reduces the number of youth who smoke by 7%. So this is a particularly effective intervention when it comes to preventing youth from starting to smoke in the first place. In our tobacco prevention program, one of the things that's become very apparent to us recently is the disparity in tobacco use that we have between different income groups. It turns out that about 36% of low-income Oregonians smoke, compared to 11% of upper-income Oregonians. That's more than three times the rate. And when you consider the fact that a pack-a-day smoker, which is kind of your average smoker, spends roughly $1,400 a year on cigarettes, this is taking an enormous burden, imposing an enormous burden, particularly on low-income people.
Now, I take it we shouldn't conclude from the first thing that if those people quit smoking, they'll earn more than $50,000 a year.
Yeah. Chair Greenlick, no comment on that.
Economic development tool.
We know that households below the median income level are four times more likely to reduce smoking or quit in response to price increases. So for this group, they have an extraordinarily high burden, and they're also very sensitive to taxes in a way that could be beneficial for them. So now I'm going to shift. I know I told you I was going to talk about health. I've told you this is a way of reducing the health burden of tobacco, that taxes are an effective way to do that. I want to talk a little bit now about the taxes themselves. I'm not an expert in this area, so if I misspeak in any way, and I know that this is not the Revenue Committee as well, but I think a little bit of acquaintance with this is important for some of the points that I need to make a little bit later. So in the 2007 and 2009 biennial budget, there were $431 million in tobacco taxes. The lion's share of that, $342 million went to the Oregon Health Fund. You can see the other uses there. $15 million to the Tobacco Use Reduction Account. That is the source of money that is used for our tobacco prevention and education program.
We are going to have more on the revenue next Wednesday from legislative revenue to talk about the taxes and a variety of issues from a revenue perspective.
So our tobacco prevention program, I think, is one of the most effective programs we have, maybe even in all of state government. This graph shows per capita cigarette consumption. The yellow line is in the United States, and the green line is in Oregon. And what you can see is that up until our program started in 1997, we were about neck and neck with the U.S., maybe a little bit above. But soon after the program started, the consumption of tobacco really started to plummet. And in fact, it dropped at about twice the rate of what was happening in other parts of the country. Now, in the 2003 session, we had a budget crisis. The funding was initially cut entirely, and then at the very end of session was restored to about 50% of its original level. And this had a really a devastating effect on our program. When the funding was cut, we let go large numbers of staff, particularly in our county health departments. We lost a great deal of momentum, a lot of expertise, and it was really very, very difficult. And what you see in this graph, I think, is that the decline that was pretty dramatic that we had had up until that point started to slow and, in fact, reversed itself a little bit. In the last session, fortunately, the funding was restored, and we have, since that time, seen the fall continue. So the point I'm trying to make here is that the effectiveness of our prevention program is directly related to funding for it. This is not an experience that's unique to Oregon. Many other states, California had a very dramatic example of this, and other states as well. Okay. One of the areas that I noted the tobacco taxes are used for the current biennium budget is for the Oregon Health Plan. So in this slide, you can see that the revenue from tobacco taxes is about $342 million that's spent on the Oregon Health Plan. But in fact, it costs the health plan for tobacco-related illnesses $574 million. And in a way, this is a deficit of $232 million that is not being paid for with those cigarette funds. It's coming from other places. I wanted to make a note about the Master Settlement Agreement. We often get asked questions about this. Are we using this for tobacco prevention? Actually not. We don't get any money for prevention. The $181 million came to Oregon in 2007-09 for the Master Settlement Agreement, and $144 million of that was used to pay off bonds. The rest has gone into other kinds of projects, but not prevention.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
And just those $144 million used to pay off bonds, do we know what those were to pay? I mean, what bonds?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, I believe that those were used for OHSU in some of their expansion efforts. Is that correct?
I thought it was to pay for the lights during our last recession.
Mm-hmm. Into the general fund. Mm-hmm.
The black hole
and wasted on things like prisons and stuff like
I think it's relevant because it was a backfill to literally pay for operational costs to just get us through the last
wasn't here then. I think
yes, we secure we securitized the master settlement agreement. Yes.
And to get out of the 2001
2002 special sessions.
2002 special session.
Kind of a scary thought given today.
Yep. Okay. We need another settlement.
Several.
Okay, so the bill that you're going to that we're having the hearing on today, this 60-cent increase, this would increase the pack price by 12%, and our estimate is that this would result in 21,492 fewer youth who would begin smoking, 6,670 fewer deaths from tobacco, and 14,383 fewer adult smokers. So this would have a substantial impact on the health of Oregonians, both in the short and the long term, and also would generate a substantial amount of revenue. As you can see there, $482 million was the estimate, and if you include OTP, which is other tobacco products, even higher at $559 million.
So that's for every 10 cents, you save 100 deaths? Is that something like that? Maybe.
Mr. Chair?
President Garrett.
Question about the revenue figure. It looks like that's more than a 100% increase in expected new revenue. But revenue for 2007-09 was $431 million on a previous slide. I'm looking at that handout you gave us.
Yeah.
Tobacco taxes in 2007-09 was $431 million.
Yeah.
You're saying with a 60-cent increase, which is less than a 100% increase, we get more than 100% gain in revenue. How does that work?
That is a good question. This must be an error here.
Good job. I think it's four slides previous.
Yeah. This was the one you're referring to, right?
You see my question?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So I'm just curious how that methodology is.
The dollar pack got the $400 million. Is that the point? Right. Is that right?
Yeah, the current $1.18 gets us $431 million. By raising it 60 cents,
you would think
we more than
like
double the amount. So that's my confusion.
50%.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Garrett, I'm sorry, that must be an error on this slide. Your question makes perfect sense to me.
Is that the total revenue? Is the 481 the total of the new revenue?
It's the total revenue.
Because it's about a 60% addition to what was 300 and something.
Well, we were at 431. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'll have to get back to you with the correct figures. I'm sorry.
Okay,
about that.
Great.
Okay.
Actually, we're going to hear from the revenue people on Wednesday. Mel knows a lot about public health, but although you're usually good with numbers. So. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mel.
You're an epidemiologist.
Right.
Chair Greenlick, I appreciate that. I prefaced my remarks by saying I'm not the revenue guy. So I'm afraid I wouldn't assume.
And you've just proven it.
Yes. So at the risk of going even further down the wrong path here, I do have some information on the federal tax increase that was just passed. It's a 61.66 cent per pack increase. Will go into effect on April 1st, and it brings other tobacco taxes in line with cigarette taxes as well. And our estimate is that the effect this will have on consumption, assuming that nothing changed with the rate at which we're taxing, would be a decrease of $23 million in the next biennium.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I thought that was an annual figure, not a biennial figure, the $23 million. I mean, there was a range, both the Congressional Budget Office and our legislative revenue, but I thought those were by annual.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer. Exactly right.
Okay.
Again, sorry. Okay, so finally, I want to talk about some of the things that having watched debates about tobacco tax over the years, these are things that come up over and over and over again, and I want to share with you some response to them, because I'm sure you're going to hear them through the course of this session as the discussion about whether to pass the tax or not goes forward. So the first is that governmental revenues decline since people buy fewer cigarettes. And in fact, there is lots of experience showing that revenues rise with the increase in taxes. The net revenue is an increase. And that's because there's less than a proportionate decline in consumption. A 10% price increase reduces consumption by only 4%, not by 10%.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Doctor, though, you'd have to admit, though, that that's at some point that argument becomes wrong. I mean, they're not completely price inelastic forever. I realize at a certain price level, maybe you get that 10-4, but at when cigarettes are whatever they are, $4 a pack, but if they're $14 a pack or $24 a pack, obviously that stops being reality.
That's a sweet price. That's the sweet spot I'm looking for.
You're looking for $24
yeah.
a pack?
Well, whatever whatever it is to get people to quit smoking.
Well, $24 a pack would probably do it.
Mr. Chair? Your model have that?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bruin, that's absolutely right, although there's lots of evidence to suggest that we're still on the part of the curve where these
more taxes equal more revenue.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
But it becomes marginally less.
You're trying to find, right, but you're trying to find that perfect equilibrium where that next penny is where you equal out, and it's the penny past that where you start decreasing the tax revenue.
No, I want to keep going until it turns to zero.
Then we better not fund it with a long-term growth health care program.
Absolutely.
Or use the revenues to fund it. Eh?
No, I think that's a very important point and a legitimate point. I think the extent to which we use it to reduce smoking, which I think is an important point, you have to balance with the fact that it marginally, until you get to that point, reduces the money that you can put into smoking reduction independently. So somewhere along the line, you have to... in this model, if it was real, you'd have to have the tax sufficient so that you don't need to use tobacco use revenue, reduction revenue for other purposes. I think we have Representative Thompson and... Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, could you ask revenue to explore that issue? My recollection is when we raised cigar taxes a few years ago, that did in fact reduce our revenue.
They will be here on Wednesday to talk to us about that.
You could ask them maybe to take a look at that. I don't remember the numbers, but I think it was rather remarkable, if I remember right.
What's the question that you asked?
The question was, where is the point, did we have experience when we reduce, when we increase, dramatically increase the taxes on cigars, it as a result of that, had a net reduction in revenue rather than
true.
A marginal reduction.
Yeah.
But you may have hit the sweet point on that one.
Could be.
So, next, again, speaking to this question, at least with respect to cigarettes, this idea that the revenue from taxes on tobacco are not stable. And again, as Representative Bruin has pointed out, this is where we are on that particular price elasticity curve. But there's every time we have had a significant state tax increase for cigarettes, it has resulted in significant increases in state tax revenue. And this graph shows overall state cigarette taxes and tax revenues. The pink line is taxes, and you can see that the revenue goes up along with the taxes as well. So in other words, you're paying more per pack of cigarettes, and there is some decrement in the number of packs that's bought, but it's more than offset by the increased revenue that you're getting per pack.
I thought there's a big drop in revenue there at 71, isn't there?
Dropping the tax.
But the tax reduced as well. There you go. Reducing the tax stops cigarette smoking. Now I got it. That may not be your point.
No. These are tax revenues, not cigarette smoke.
Oh, tax revenues.
Right. So in other words, the amount of revenue parallels the amount of tax. Let me show you another example. This is
Wait a minute, go back. I need to understand this slide. Is that amount of tax or the tax per pack?
Tax rate and tax revenue.
Well, why did tax rate dropped so dramatically between 71 and...
It's inflation adjusted, and you had rampant inflation.
Now I got it. Thank you, Jimmy Carter. I got that. Okay, I'm sorry.
And then we're going to call gas.
So here again,
20% CPI.
This is Washington State, and you can see the pink line, the tax rate increasing and revenue increasing in step with that. The tax in Washington State, incidentally, is a little over $2 a pack. I believe it's $2.12 a pack. Then there's this issue about cigarette taxes and people with lower incomes. We've talked about this already, but, you know, a pack-a-day smoker spends about $1,400 a year. Increased prices will help many lower-income Oregonians quit, freeing up more money for other needs that they have.
Dr. Cohn?
Yes.
I apologize.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I don't, but...
I mean, go ahead and apologize first. That's it.
Okay. I mean, if you look at the percentage of low-income people that smoke, it's the reality is that they smoke at a greater rate than do higher income. So I think, in fact, it is a regressive tax. We want them to stop. I mean, I'm not quite sure I totally buy that myth truth slide, because I do believe it is a regressive tax.
I suppose it depends how you define negative.
It doesn't say about
it helps
this
them
doesn't
more
say about regressive or
they have
or
a more likely a higher likelihood to stop smoking, therefore because they don't have the ability to keep smoking. It's sort of an I mean the logic's there, but it's sort of a sort
yeah,
of
but
a force.
Ron's point though is that those who do smoke are now paying an even higher amount of their limited income.
Right, that's right. Which if you're a rational economist, you believe, well, therefore, if there is such a thing, if that's not a contradiction in terms, well, leads you to believe that, therefore, they will take action for their own in their own best interest and use the $1,400 a year for something they would rather do if there's something they would rather do than smoke.
Probably not the thinking of a NATO.
Or rather not do, yes.
But I think it's the power of the addiction
that
really...
Absolutely. That's what I think the power of addiction is really important, and that's what makes preventing adolescence from beginning smoking. Mm-hmm. The one way you're not affected by that addiction is if you never have taken your first cigarette. And that's a really interesting thing. I mean, when you analyze the data, it sounds like a stupid thing, but when you analyze the data, an extraordinarily large proportion of people who have never smoked, who aren't smoking and who never smoked, never had the first cigarette. It wasn't that, I can have a few and then I'm okay. The fact is this is a highly addictive product. So your concern with the people who are addicted is a real concern. But we need to be also really cognizant of, because this is a highly addictive substance, you want to do what you can to prevent kids from using it.
The other issue with respect to low-income Oregonians is how the revenue that's generated is used. And if you're low-income, much more likely to be on the Oregon Health Plan. And this slide shows that... I'm sorry?
It's the only way you get on the Oregon Health Plan.
That's right. The cost to low... Chair Greenlick, but not necessarily
everyone
is on the Oregon
right.
Health
we'll
Plan.
Do something about that, too.
Cost to low-income Oregonians from the tax, this is the proposed 60-cent a pack increase, factoring in the decrease in smoking and the increase in price from federal tax, is about $7.5 million. And yet the increased funds that are generated for the health plan, $41.5 million. So the net gain in terms of services for Oregonians, $34 million. And this is purely looking at health plan costs. Of course, people who are smoking have sick leave, increased sick days, issues with productivity related to that, illness in their children who are exposed to secondhand smoke, and so forth. So this analysis doesn't take into account that issue.
May I? So this is accounting for the S-CHIP, the 61-62% increase at the federal level, reduces our revenue by $23 million, but you have to double that, or you have to 1 times 1.66 because of the federal match.
How does the S-CHIP decrease the revenue because it has a smoking attached to it?
Well, I guess we need legislative revenue, but the forecast is our tax revenue is going to be decreased by $23 million a year or a biennium.
From the smoking. I mean, from the smoking tax, the 60-cent smoking tax.
The federal.
Yeah, no, I understand. But is that attached to S-CHIP? Did they come together?
Yes. Yeah. But it goes to the federal government.
Right.
Which turns around increases more people on S-CHIP, and the figure is 42,000 ballpark. But we lose $23 million.
From the smoking. Now I understand what you were saying.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, this estimate is based on the number of smokers in the low-income category, which would decline when the price goes up, regardless of what increases the price, and then that's multiplied by a per-pack amount. That's where the $7.5 million comes from.
A question I'm going to have is, was the federal increase in the tax for S-CHIP ultimately a good deal for us or a not-so-good deal for us? Because of there's federal match that has to be played into this at 1.66 times the dollar that we lost. And is it better for the feds to increase their taxes, or is it better for the state to increase their taxes?
This is really an interesting model. We need somebody to run. But I would hypothesize the extent to which smokers in a smaller proportion of Oregon population smokes, we come out by having a federal match at an advantage compared to states that has higher smoking, right? And we're pretty far down in the list on adult smoking, aren't we?
Chair Greenlick, I believe we're fairly close to the middle, actually. There are states who have lower.
So it may be a wash in that sense in terms of who benefits and gains from it.
Okay.
You having fun yet?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Could just be a coincidence. You said we're near the middle in terms of per capita consumption. I believe we're correct.
I believe that's correct.
And I believe that we're also near the middle in terms of taxes. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, too. That would probably be a better question for legislative fiscal. But
all right.
Does
anyone know if the states with the highest taxes have the lowest consumption? No. To be asked again later.
That's an interesting model. I mean, I think there are people that have worked on that model, but would you find that out? See if you can find a question being, and I suppose it has to be a multidimensional model that has other risk factors involved.
Sure. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mazin from the Legislative Revenue Office has that. He's presented it to us 2 years ago, and it'll be presented again.
He's going to be here on Wednesday.
Yeah, he knows that.
Great.
I'll give
him
that. Okay, thanks. It's off the hook.
And then, in addition, you mentioned the issues with the addictiveness of tobacco use and the large burden on low-income people. To the extent that the funds generated go to pay for prevention programs, that's also a benefit that accrues to low-income people. So it increases their motivation to quit. In fact, we know that low-income people tend to say that they want to quit at the same rate as upper-income people. They report trying to quit at the same rate, and the problem is that they relapse. And so, again, a prevention program that addresses some of those conditions in the community that will support people in not smoking and also provide some of the assistance that they need to quit will benefit those very same folks. This is another issue that's been raised many times, that when taxes on tobacco go up, tax evasion then becomes a big problem. And again, the amount of the tax matters here. But our experience in the past has been that the extent of tax evasion is often very highly overstated. And even in the presence of some tax evasion, there still is a very definite increase in net revenue.
Some of that might be price sensitive, too. My $24 a pack model would probably move a lot of cigarettes from Kentucky.
Yeah, but the tax evasion, if you have a differential between Oregon and the state of Washington, that's essentially a tax evasion. I mean, that's legal, probably, crossing the state. But I think it is the true black market of cigarettes when you do get to a point where it's now profitable for the underworld to sell black market cigarettes, then they will.
Yeah, there might be some benefit for that. My understanding is when we cut smoking in the state prisons, the underground channel of smuggling, cigarettes and matches pushed all other drugs out of the smuggling channel. The wardens were really happy about it. Matches were selling for $1 a piece. So maybe if we could get the Mexican the Mexican mafia interested in moving cigarettes rather than cocaine, we might have another thing going for us here.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
On this issue, don't we already have a big problem with internet sales of cigarettes in this state? Seems like I've seen some reports in the last year.
Ask LRO about that. They'll have some estimates, I think.
Because that internet's a relatively new bootlegging method that's really easy, delivered straight to your home. I think that might actually figure into this as opposed to black market outlets, you know, on the dark alley sort of thing.
Certainly hasn't wiped it out yet, I think. I've seen.
At some point, internet has to become very, very popular, especially with young people who know how to use it and use that route every day anyway.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Thompson, the Attorney General has done quite a bit of work in this arena trying to crack down on this.
Yeah.
And I think the point I'm trying to make here is that even with, to whatever extent that tax evasion is happening, there still is a substantial increase in revenue here. Mm-hmm. Certainly not in favor of tax evasion. That's a problem, and we should be addressing that. But
no, the point I'm trying to make is that the internet is a relatively new phenomenon. Tax evasion through all of the routes may actually be dwarfed by the internet against a price or a tax increase, because it is so readily available. You don't have to go to the back alley and find Guido. You know, you can just simply sit down at home and order them for UPS delivery. Yeah.
Mel, how are you doing on time?
How are you doing on time? Okay.
You better get toward wrapping up.
Okay. Thank you. Here are my conclusions. The increases in tobacco tax increase state revenues. They help smokers quit. They keep kids from starting to smoke. And they help people with lower incomes quit smoking. The bottom line is that decreases in tobacco use make Oregon healthier and will save us money, and that additional gains can be achieved by investing the funds that are generated from these kinds of taxes in effective tobacco prevention. Thank you.
Well, you've been a hero in this area for a long time. We really do appreciate your steadfast fight in this, and I hope we can do something to help the process along this way. Thank you very much. Unless there's any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We have five folks who want to...
Representative Thompson,
yes?
I have a question.
I'm sorry?
And I have a question. If the governor's motives are pure, and I'm not questioning that they are, and this is this big a health care problem, why isn't he sending us a bill to outlaw cigarettes in Oregon? That would help low income, save us, $242 million on the Oregon Health Plan, certainly impact youth smoking.
You want to co-sponsor one with me?
I didn't say I co-sponsored. I'm just asking the rhetorical question. I mean, well, why aren't we the first state in the union to outlaw smoking if it's this big of a problem and taxes as an income factor are not important?
Strategically, we're doing it with death by a thousand cuts.
Oh.
You'll have some
and we're making huge state profits off of it as we go.
Yeah, well, We have one of our colleagues wants an estimate on how much money we make out of children smoking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's an important question to be asking.
Yeah.
No, that's a legitimate. The obvious answer is we don't think you could do it, but I'd be willing to try if you were. Dr. Cohn, thank you very much. There are five folks who want to testify in favor of this. I'm going to...
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Could I ask a quick question before you...
Before he goes?
No, to you, actually.
Oh, yes. So, yes, thank you, Dr. Cohn.
I don't want to get too far ahead of the wagon here, but is your intent with 2122 to pass it out with recommendation? If we get to a work session, I know it's not today, but what is your intent with this bill? Or is it to hear it? Because obviously this is a revenue bill, ultimately.
Yeah, as I said before, I've been communicating with the revenue committee, and our job here is to look at health effects.
Right.
And talk about relative rates and revenue around different health issues. It's up to them as to whether or not they want it to continue along this way, which has a number in it, or do some other numbers. The question is that's not decided.
Okay, thank you.
But the real work will go to the revenue committee on it.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it has a subsequent referral to revenue and ways and means. Revenue first, and then on to ways and means.
Representative Cote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will we have an opportunity today to talk about how the money is going to be spent? Is that the purview of this committee?
I think that's
in terms of the distribution.
I think that's totally
okay.
Not today. I don't think we have room in today's.
Do we have someone who can come when we have LRO here next week to talk about
or,
the distribution,
or subsequent to that? But I think, right. Yeah, I think we really, I think that's the thing we can add to it, because we're the substantive committee, and the notion of how you distribute that money would be, I think, of issue.
And for what purpose? And,
yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no, I think... Would you like to help organize some of that?
I would love to do
I'm
that.
I'm serious. That would be very useful.
Okay.
And remember that somebody in transportation wants 3.5 cents or something for...
Well, some of us on our committee want other things, too.
So, no, that's right.
Yeah, right, so no, I'd be happy to do that.
That'd be great. Thank
okay.
you very
much. You're welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask the five of you to limit your remarks to 3 minutes, if you can. We'll continue to have things, or you can introduce written testimony after. We need Alejandro Corral, is that? Am I saying that correctly? David Rabineau and Lila Wickham. We have a communication we'll put into the record where the... would you comment on that, please?
Yes.
We're gonna
put,
yeah.
That's for a different bill, sir.
A different bill, I'm sorry. Really?
Yes. That was 2133.
I got it. I'm sorry. I'm not good with numbers today either. Please start.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Granlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alejandro Queral, and I am the State Director of Government Relations for the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association. We are also part of the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon. On behalf of our members, I'm here to express support for HB 2122. Dr. Cohn's presentation highlighted the human and economic cost of tobacco and the impact it has on our state. We know that if we include the cost of these costs to a pack of cigarettes, the retail price would increase by about $7. We also know that an increase of this magnitude would encourage many current smokers to quit. As Dr. Cohen mentioned, research has shown that a 10% increase in the retail price reduces smoking overall consumption by about 4%. Revenue still increased because a higher tax rate per pack will bring in more revenue than is lost from the tax-related drop in total pack sales. So even a 60-cent increase would not only bring much-needed increase in revenue, it would also reduce smoking rates among youth by more than 8%, and more than 9,000 current Oregon smokers would quit. In addition, the revenue generated by the tax itself, Oregonians would save because reduced need for medical care and fewer premature deaths caused by tobacco use. But what happens when smoking rates go up? When the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program was defunded in 2004, consumption rates among pregnant women increased. And even an increase of 1% in consumption could have a significant impact on the state and on individuals. For instance, the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids estimates that a 1% increase in smoking rates would mean that there would be more than 2,800 new adult smokers and 2,000 more high school smokers every year. Adult deaths caused by smoking would increase by more than 7,000, and nearly 3,000 youth would grow up to die from smoking. Not surprisingly, the incidence of heart attacks and strokes would also increase, resulting in greater demand for expensive medical procedures that contribute to skyrocketing costs of health insurance. In fact, over a five-year period, health costs for more heart attacks and strokes alone would add up to more than $11 million. In short, the American Heart Association supports increasing tobacco taxes because of the positive health outcomes for individuals and the public, and the significant savings to the taxpayer due to avoided medical costs and premature death. We also support allocating a significant portion of the revenue to the prevention and cessation programs, as this will increase the impact of the cigarette tax. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. David, welcome.
Hello, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Rubinall. I'm a program officer with the Northwest Health Foundation, which is an independent public charitable institution here in Oregon, and a member of the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon, and I'm here today speaking in favor of House Bill 2122. When considering tobacco taxes, it's important to think long-term. While the upfront cost of a tobacco tax may be 60 cents per pack, the long-term benefits are dramatic, starting a chain of events that goes far beyond the price hike. Increasing the price of cigarettes is proven, as you've heard, to decrease cigarette consumption, especially amongst kids, who can take decades to quit once they've become addicted. Fewer smokers produce less tobacco-related costs to the public, which this cost has been estimated to be as much as $2.1 billion per year here in Oregon. Furthermore, the public is in favor of tobacco taxes, especially when they are used to prevent tobacco use and recover smoking-related health costs. A recent survey, which I handed out to all of you, a recent survey commissioned by the Northwest Health Foundation for the Oregon Health Fund Board and conducted by Davis, Hibbets, and Mitchell, a polling firm, found that 67% of those voters surveyed supported increasing the cigarette tax by 60 cents to pay for public education programs to prevent and reduce tobacco use and obesity and to recover smoking-related health care costs in the Oregon Health Plan. I further point out that 55% of these respondents strongly supported this. So Northwest Health Foundation has continued to engage Oregon communities in all of its positions and joins other public health and healthcare organizations in supporting House Bill 2122. Thank you.
David, thank you very much. Nice to see you again.
Good seeing you.
Good afternoon. Representatives, my name is Lila Wickham. I'm representing the conference, the Coalition of Local Health Officials today. In my day job, I work for Multnomah County Health Department. And we're really in support of this bill, but specifically speaking to Representative Kotek's mention of what will happen on the spending side of this bill. So, assuming it passes and that we have the funding to spend. But the point is that public health is really in the business of doing prevention, and it would be really important to utilize resources from this bill to support prevention activities. And as all of you know, public health has a long history of doing all kinds of prevention activities, like assuring access to prenatal care, women, infant, and children programs, immunizations, directed observed therapy for tuberculosis. And all of those things are a return on investment that reduces the healthcare costs in the end. There's a in the little handout that you have from the Coalition of Local Health Officials, it specifically speaks to the Trust for America's Health 2008 study that talked about return on investment in prevention, and specifically talks about a $10 per person investment in chronic disease prevention at the community level would save Oregon $193 million over 5 years. So it's really about that return on investment that I'm speaking. Last fall, the Coalition of Local Health Officials did an assessment of local public health departments and identified a significant gap in the comprehensive services that are able to be provided at the local level. So the point of that statement is that public health really has the infrastructure to do prevention work, but lacks the capacity at the current level of funding to do that comprehensively. I would also say that public health is poised to do the chronic disease work that's so critical for better health and long-term cost savings. And I would point to obesity, using initiatives like menu labeling, better food in schools, better food in child care centers. I would point to the public health work around asthma trigger interventions that could be conducted in child care centers, homes, schools. So the point is, we're poised to do this work, and but lack the capacity to do it comprehensively. And I think, as David mentioned, the polling that the Northwest Health Foundation convened, one of the things that the poll said was people expect their local public health department to be providing this kind of service, and we need to be able to meet that expectation. And then I think probably the last thing is I have a little sewing kit that I got from my grandmother that I really hold dear, and it was designed in the 1800s, and on the top of it, it says, it's embossed, a stitch in time saves nine. And I just think that it's really important that we, you know, have that mentality about how we invest our scarce resources.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Thanks for being here. And thanks for your hard work in this area. Important. Raquel Bruno-Niske and Don Austin. How'd I do?
It's Raquel Bruno-Niske.
Bruno-Niske.
Very close.
I was close. The QUE got me. Bruno-Niske. Did I get your name right, Austin?
Yes, you did, Chairman.
Thank you, sir.
Exactly right.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. I'm Raquel Bruno-Niske with Upstream Public Health. Upstream is an organization dedicated to improving the health of all Oregonians, and we are also a member of TOFCO, the Tobacco-Free Coalition of Oregon. In conversations with legislators, I often state that tobacco is the number one cause of preventable death in Oregon. And there's often a pause, and then the response, really? Still? Yes, we've made great progress in reducing death and disease resulting from tobacco use, thanks to the state's tobacco prevention and education program. But tobacco is still the leading cause of death in Oregon, and there is much more to be done. So thank you for hearing testimony today on this important issue. Upstream believes it is a moral imperative that the state do what we know works to prevent the harm caused by this addictive and deadly product. We want to tax cigarettes because cigarettes kill people. A cigarette tax is one of the most effective means of stopping people from smoking and preventing youth from picking up the habit. Currently, Oregon ranks middle of the road on cigarette taxes, and I think you all agree, Oregon isn't average. Oregon doesn't deserve average. Nine states, including Washington, already have taxes of $2 or more. Even with a new 60-cent tax, we end up barely over $1.75. Last time we tried to pass a tobacco tax, the tobacco industry spent an unprecedented $12 million to defeat it. Why did they spend $12 million? Because the tobacco industry knows that people will quit, and we know that too. Basic economic theory tells us that for every 10% we raise the price of cigarettes, we see a 4% decrease in use among adults and 6% with youth. So let's look at the practical effects of this proposal. Even putting the issue of revenue aside, this is a good public health policy because it leads people to quit. Other smokers may need more encouragement to quit, which is why a significant portion of the new revenue should go to tobacco prevention and cessation programs. Some low-income families will also benefit greatly from this tax because low-income smokers are more price-sensitive and therefore more likely to quit. Saving lives, saving money. Given these health benefits and the resulting economic benefits, House Bill 2122 is one of the most important bills the legislature is considering this year, and we urge you to pass it. I would be happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Austin, another public health hero with us today. Welcome.
Thank you. Representative Greenlake and members of the committee, my name is Donald Austin, and I'm a physician specializing in preventive medicine, and I'm honored to be here today representing the Oregon Public Health Association. That is the organization of public health professionals that places at their highest priority the health of Oregonians. I want to thank you for the opportunity to comment on House Bill 2122, Governor Kulongoski's tobacco tax proposal, which OPHA strongly supports for several reasons. One and foremost, the tobacco tax will provide needed revenue to help defray a budget cut that would cripple important programs that protect the health of our citizens. Also important is the effect that the tobacco tax will have on cigarette smoking in Oregon. Smoking will decrease, partly as a result of this tax and partly as a result of the new federal tobacco tax. And lastly, this bill also taxes other tobacco products, which is very important because although they are not the most hazardous product, they have their own health costs on the state. In the past several years, the prevalence of smoking nationally has declined, and in Oregon, as you can see on the back of this handout, had declined to under 17% for all adults in Oregon. We haven't done quite as well as California, but we've done rather well. And the reduction in the prevalence of cigarette smoking is really a good news, bad news story. The good news is that cigarette smoking has reduced by approximately a quarter over the last decade in this state. Nationally, it's declined about 20% during that time. And we expect additional smoking reduction to result from the recent expansion on the ban on indoor smoking in public places in Oregon, and also the very recently enacted federal cigarette tax. One economist predicted that the S-CHIP law, signed into law last week, will reduce nationwide cigarette consumption by an estimated 6 to 7%. And the passage of the governor's tax proposal will add to that reduction. That's the good news. The bad news is that many people addicted to nicotine have switched to cheaper products. Over the past decade, the consumption of little cigars has tripled. The consumption of large cigars has increased by 50%. Since 2002, the nationwide consumption of smoking tobacco, loose smoking tobacco, mostly roll your own, has doubled. Consumption of moist snuff has increased by 50%. So last year, the weekly cost for a typical smoker of a premium moist snuff brand was 55% less than that for a typical cigarette smoker. State and federal cigarette taxation policies appear to have been effective in reducing smoking, but small cigars and roll-your-own tobacco have been taxed at roughly 5 to 10% of the rate of cigarettes, resulting in prices much less than the equivalent pack of cigarettes. The governor's proposed tax increase is needed, number one, to avoid a 6 to 7% loss of tobacco tax revenues, two, to recover more of the tobacco-caused health care costs incurred by Oregon, but also to reduce the market for other tobacco products. Granted, these other tobacco products are not as lethal as cigarettes, but those that are not smoked, don't affect the health of non-smokers, but they do have their own adverse health consequences. Now, regarding the prevention of smoking initiation and helping those who do smoke to quit, we picked most of the low-hanging fruit with taxation. I used to be able to say that all we needed to do was raise the tax, and if we just threw the money off the bridge, we'd still help people because the smoking would be less and their disease burden would be less. A recent analysis of the effect of taxation on cigarettes done by researchers at the University of California, Davis, confirmed the well-known overall effect overall effect of cigarette taxation on smoking cessation, but found that while cessation was great among the well-educated and the wealthy, it was very little among the really poor. As the overall smoking prevalence decreases, we are left with those that are more refractive to change, the ones who most need our help. Because of that, it's important that taxation not be the only tool in the tobacco control toolbox. Current smokers need help more than ever, and it's essential that adequate revenues from the proposed tax be directed to help current smokers quit. Preventing young people from starting to smoke is good. It reduces health costs down the road in the future. Helping current smokers quit prevents extra health costs in this fiscal year.
Don, this is you wrap it up for
us? I will do that.
Thank you.
I want to emphasize that we need a multifaceted cigarette tobacco program to reduce smoking, that on a per-pack basis, the direct and indirect cost to Oregon of cigarette smoking, the direct cost alone is about $11.16. With these two taxes, this one and the federal tax, the state cost of a package of cigarette will be about half that. OPHA respectfully urges your support for the passage of this bill, and I'll be pleased to answer any questions or provide any information that you want.
Thank you, Dr. Austin. Questions? Thank you very much. Where'd Denver go? Coming back?
Yeah, the stuff is here. It's coming back.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 2122. We'll be hearing more and more of this, and I really thank you all for joining us.
There he is. You can start.
Okay.
Good.
Representative Harker?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow certain individuals to be recorded as voting on H.J.R. 12.
Is there any objection to that motion? I open a public hearing, a work session on H.J.R. 12. And ask each of you. Okay, Representative Maurer, how do you vote on H.J.R. 12?
Aye.
Representative Denbrough, how do you vote on H.J. 12? Representative Kennemer, how do you vote on H.J. 12?
Okay.
That
Thank
it?
You.
We have a unanimous vote on H.J. 12, and we'll see it on the floor. Close the work session. I'm going to open a public hearing and work session on H.B. 2133. And I call Dr. Skeels to the podium.
Mr. Chair, while Mr. Skeels is coming forward,
I'm going to tell us what we got. Why don't you tell us what the bill is?
Well, the bill eliminates the current statutory fee cap for the public health laboratory fees that they charge. Currently, there's a $50 cap on all tests other than newborn specimen screening tests, which is $30 cap. This requires DAS to approve the fee prior to any increase. There's a couple of things I want to highlight. You will notice that this is scheduled for a work session, and you do have a fiscal impact statement. However, that statement does not have a fiscal amount on it. It is just an explanation that is in your packet. And also, Mr. Chair,
Is it sufficient for us to pass the bill?
I gave mine away, Mr. Chair, and I will have to look at yours. I need to look at the comment on it. I gave mine to Katie King, so... No, come up here this way.
No. That's all right. All right, I got it.
Yeah.
Dr. Skeels, will you? You got it.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, good afternoon. There's a risk that I'm going to give you legislative whiplash going from the leading preventable cause of death and disability down to how much we charge for lab tests, but thank you for your attention. As was said, this is a bill that relates to the Oregon State Public Health Laboratory, which I direct, and we're part of the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. And we hope that you'll vote for House Bill 2133 because it would allow our lab to keep up with a lot of new and rapidly changing technologies and would help us provide critically important services to both the state's public health system and also to the private medical laboratories who are our clients in Oregon. With your permission, what I'd like to do is just give a little background and context, Mr. Chair, about what we do in our laboratory that relates to the fees that we charge. Is that
quickly,
all right?
Please.
Okay, thanks.
But, you know, you don't have any opposition to this one. This is the one so far that you have three votes. Don't go for two.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to conclude my testimony.
Any questions at this time? Why don't you take another minute?
Okay, thank you, sir. We do a lot of communicable disease testing, a wide array of it in our lab, and almost all of it is paid for using federal funds and state general fund, with a very small fraction of it being paid for with fees that we charge. And
I hear you may not have identified yourself to start. Just
actually,
didn't.
I just did, Mr. Chair. I said okay. The Oregon State Public Health Laboratory, which I direct, and I'm Mike Skeels.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Anyway, we do a lot of different kinds of communicable disease testing in our laboratory, and our main clients are local health departments, and we use state general funds and federal funds to pay for almost all of this testing, but there is a small amount of it that we pay with fee revenues, and we charge for a few of the things that we do for local health departments if they're for samples that don't quite meet public health criteria, but they're a high priority for the local health department. And we also charge a little bit for some kinds of tests that we do for private laboratories that submit things to us because they'd like us to do the testing. So that particular kind of fee revenue in our laboratory is not a major source of funding for us, but we use it to do some of the most important things that we do. The other area where we charge fees, however, is big for us, and that's the newborn screening program. And we charge fees for screening babies who are born in Oregon for about 40 different disorders, which, if undetected, can cause severe irreversible damage and, in some cases, even death to these children. So this is a fee that's charged to hospitals and practitioners in the state for doing the testing, and it also includes the medical consultation and the referral and the confirmation testing if it's necessary for a given child. So that's where the fees are used in our laboratory. And because we have statutory caps, there's been a problem whenever we want to recover the full cost for performing tests. And often because of the big increases in the cost for reagents and materials and instruments and all the kinds of things that we do, we've not been able to offer certain kinds of tests because they would cost us more than we're allowed to charge. And so I won't read my testimony to you, but you can see some examples that I've given here of the kinds of charges that private labs have to pay to send things out of state for reference laboratory testing. And in fact, the labs would like us to be able to set up and do the same testing in Oregon for much lower charge. And I'll just conclude by saying that we've been very judicious in our application of fees and raising of fees. The last time we increased our fee for newborn screening was in October of 2002, and at that time it was so that we could expand from screening each infant for six disorders up to about 40 disorders, which we do now. And the last time we raised our fees for communicable disease testing was in April of 1998. So we don't do this willy-nilly, and we will not start doing it willy-nilly. We're always careful to make sure that we do a fiscal analysis and that we're recovering our costs, which is the legislative direction that we have. So laboratory science is undergoing a big revolution. We're getting to the point where we do more and more tests using DNA and other molecular probes. They cost more money, and frankly, the technology is changing faster than the statute can change, and the cap has been a problem for us. So we're here today to ask for your support for this bill.
Thank you very much. You have a message to read, please.
I do, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, we received a memo from the Hospital Association that just says, while we understand why they are removing the statutory cap, we do anticipate being an active part of the rulemaking process. It will be important for us and others to continue to have conversations on appropriate lab fees. So just for the record, the Hospital Systems and Association and such would like to participate in the rulemaking process.
And the fiscal says that the bill will not have a fiscal impact on DAS because approval by DAS is already an existing requirement for all agencies that charge fees to the general public.
and the passage of the bill does not require additional resources or result in increased workload for DHS. So I think we are free to move it. Representative Kotek?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. So I want to go to the next paragraph on the fiscal analysis. It talks about the desire to withdraw policy option package 356 for increased lab fees. Is it? I'm trying to remember in the other fund dollars that we're sweeping out of public health to balance the 0709 budget, are we not taking some of your ending fund balance in the public health lab?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kotek, all I have seen is a proposal to do that, so I can't really comment on what is being done. And I can tell you that the proposal that I've seen would take some of our would take general fund from the laboratory with the idea that we would backfill it with ending fund balance. But I don't actually have confirmation of that. My boss is in the room, though.
That is
so
correct.
Dr. Cohn is not.
So is the chair of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Resources. Maybe she could comment.
Well,
on that.
I mean, that, and I believe that is the case. Here's my concern, and I guess I just want to put it out there. I guess I'm not quite sure why the fiscal analysis talks about removing the policy option package. As far as I'm concerned, the fiscal can stop at, you know, no increased workload for DHS. Yeah. The decision to remove your the ability to discuss the policy option package just has me concerned. I'm sure you put it forward for very good reasons. You haven't raised your fees in many years. You're asked to do more in, you know, in public health. You know, we have a problem, for example, a food problem, the peanut butter example, for example. You're being asked to do different things. I just would love to talk with you offline about why we would be stepping back, because I have a feeling because we're taking some of your ending fund balance, a lot of money out of public health for the to get us out of this biennium, you're going to be put in a tough spot. And to totally take it off the table that you're not going to look at any increased fees for your lab just strikes me as odd. So I just want to put that out there.
You want to join us on this one?
Chairman Greenlee, may I respond just real briefly?
Yes, please.
I'll just say, Representative Kotek, that we began the budget development process. There was a lot we didn't know that we know now. And because this was a bill that had the word fees in it, we were asked to develop a policy option package and fiscal impact statement just like every other situation. And we went down that pathway. And Representative Greenlee may want to speak to this point, but he asked us, why does this have a Ways and Means referral? And we said, well, because it has a policy option package. And so that's how we ended up there. And so we went back to our department and said, this is really a policy decision, not a revenue decision at this point. And so what you see here, if assuming we're holding the same document, which is dated today, February 20th, on the bottom right, is, I believe, just an explanation. It's a comment by John Britton and his staff to explain to your committee how we got to where we are with this. That's my understanding.
And because of that follow-up, does that remove the referral to Ways and Means?
Yeah, the referral is off.
It doesn't have a referral to Ways and Means.
It didn't have a referral.
No. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. None of my records indicate any prior reference to Ways and Means.
Okay. I just don't want to disadvantage the lab to do the work they need to do and taking off the table potential fee increases. That's all. So just want to put that out there. Thank you.
Thompson?
Yeah, Dr. Scales, I think you answered this in your testimony, but just to make it really clear on the record, this is cost recovery for increased costs and not revenue enhancement?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Thompson, that's correct. In our laboratory, we only charge fees in Oregon for that recover the cost of our testing.
Okay. I would agree with Representative Kotek. I would hate to see your lab throttled by a lack of income. Maybe we need to talk more about that one provision.
But your fee increases, I'm sorry, I'm following up on that. Your fee increases go to DAS, is that right?
Chair Greenlick, actually, under the statute, the fees that we generate are for use by the Oregon State Public Health Laboratory, and so the actual cashiering function takes place within the Department of Human Services, and beyond that, I don't know how the money gets
to us. No, I'm sorry. I misread. I misstated the question.
The
this
approval
is,
the
approves fee your fees. That isn't that, something.
That's correct.
You decide one morning you're going to raise the fees and send out a...
I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question. That's correct. The process for setting the fees would not change. It's the same process we use now under the Senate Bill 333 method, where we propose DAS approves, but the approval is contingent upon this body then reviewing it at the next legislative session. So the legislature bats last on this one.
Hey, Representative Maurer, do you?
Yes. So you can't provide tests that clients want. Why would they not go to another lab?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, they sometimes do, and they still could. The only tests that we that are related to this to the fees that we charge mandated by Oregon law are the newborn screening fees. And we are the laboratory under statute that does that testing. But for the other tests, which is what I think you're asking about, they can and do go to other laboratories. But the medical laboratories are saying to us, gee, if you would do this test in Oregon for $100, we wouldn't have to send it to Utah and pay $450 for it, because we're not going to set it up in our laboratory anyway, because it's cost prohibitive and a small volume. But we'd like somebody here to be able to do it, and if you could do it at cost, that would be a good deal for us.
Okay. Thank you. We'll close the public session, the public hearing on House Bill 2133, and open a work session on House Bill 2133. Is there any discussion?
We need a motion, sir.
Ah, before discussion. All right. Let's have a motion.
This one? Mr. Chair, I would move to move House Bill 2133 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Harker moves House Bill 2133 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I just go on record quickly. I had some reservations about this when I first heard it. I appreciate the testimony that was given today and the follow-up question by Representative Thompson that says this is cost recovery rather than an income, an effort at income increase. So it relieves some of the apprehension I had.
You ready for vote? Lara, would you please call the roll?
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Excuse.
Representative Dembrough?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kenmer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. The motion passes, we'll close the work session on it, and Representative Harker, will you carry the bill on the floor, please?
Gladly, sir.
Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on, an informational meeting on House Bill 2009. We have five witnesses have asked to testify. We're glad you're here. We're sorry we held you so late on Friday. We have 30 minutes. You guys design the time however you'd like it to go. One or the other of you must be in charge of this thing.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Leslie Frayne, and I'm Executive Director of Service Employees International Union, Local 503. Our local represents over 44,000 employees in Oregon. SEIU has a deep interest in promoting quality, affordable health care. We support health care reform that guarantees affordable health care for everyone and eliminates the gaps in coverage and access to care that are inherent in our current employer-based system of health care. We believe that health care reform must take on that problem comprehensively. Attached to my written testimony are a set of principles adopted by SEIU, our international union, and another set adopted a few years ago by our local here in Oregon. These principles call for healthcare reform that leads to a system that meets certain standards. First, it must guarantee everyone a core benefit, or in Oregon language, a package of essential benefits. It must include strong preventive care and long-term care components that improve quality of life, avoid unnecessary hospital stays, and promote home and community-based long-term care whenever possible. It must control costs by demanding an efficient delivery system that provides medically effective care in a cost-efficient way. It must address racial and ethnic disparities in access to appropriate care. And finally, it must require transparency as a tool for improving quality and efficiency. While HB 2009 contains many critically needed components, we do not believe that this bill, as written, delivers fully on the principles I've described. We hope that the committee will find ways to implement certain components of HB 2009 while continuing to work toward the needed global fix for our broken healthcare system. Among the components of HB 2009 that we support are its immediate expansion of coverage to children and families with incomes below 300% of the federal poverty level and to adults with incomes below 100% of FPL. We hope that access can be expanded still further over time. We also believe that maximizing enrollment, using not only private grants, but also the talent and experience of public sector workers, will be critical in order to make sure that the program succeeds. We support the bill's provision to pay for the bulk of the 2009 coverage expansion with a hospital provider tax, so long as hospitals, which stand to benefit financially from the coverage expansion, are not permitted to pass on the tax to health plans and patients by raising their commercial rates. We were pleased to see that the bill establishes an insurance exchange and tasks it with planning for market reforms that will provide a necessary foundation for developing a hybrid public-private system that guarantees affordable coverage for all. Finally, we're excited about the potential for system improvement using the tools the bill will provide to the health authority and the insurance exchange, such as the power to develop a publicly owned health plan and to cap provider rates and insurance administrative expense loads. We urge you to examine carefully the bill's allocation of responsibilities and hope that we will have a clear plan around pooling our purchasing to make sure, in particular, that we do not lose any of the innovations of the public employee benefit that the Public Employee Benefit Board, PEB, has developed. Finally, we believe that tools for cost containment in the bill must be strengthened, and Alice Dale will address those concerns in more detail.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. I'm Alice Dale, the president of SEIU Local 49. We represent healthcare workers and property services workers throughout Oregon and Southwest Washington. I sit as a labor representative on the Oregon Health Policy Commission and have a keen interest in promoting access to quality, affordable healthcare. I also would just like to begin by applauding the committee's efforts for tackling what I think is one of the most important and maybe one of the most complicated issues in the session. And that's dealing with the access to health care for all Oregonians. So as Leslie indicated, I'm going to focus on the issue of health care costs and how we can control them. I have written testimony for you. I'll try to just highlight the key points. First, we believe that cutting health care costs is a political necessity for two reasons. One, it reduces the public expenditure necessary to make health care affordable. And second, it creates value for employers and others who have to purchase health care benefits so that they will also take the risk of changing and supporting upfront investment in health care reform. We also believe that cutting health care costs is a moral issue. We think there's a lot of public investment that needs to be spent and redirected to housing, to human services, to education, and public infrastructure. And if we can control health care costs, then those dollars can be better spent. We know that health care costs can be more affordable. There's no country that spends health care money the way the United States does, and yet citizens of other countries tend to be healthier in many cases. We think there's an opportunity to improve the quality of our health care system at the same time that we eliminate unnecessary spending for some activities that are marginal and some that are actually negatively impacting citizens. House Bill 2009 would be strengthened, we think, if it had a sharper focus on cost containment. And there are five different items I'd like to identify. First is the issue of managing prices charged for units of care. Pricing is the biggest reason that health care costs are more expensive in the United States than the rest of the developed world. There are a number of issues in here, and there are studies that we've cited in the testimony we provided, but study after study shows that other countries keep their spending for health care in check by keeping prices in check, not by having fewer doctor visits, not by having fewer hospital stays or shorter stays, but actually by reducing and controlling what we have in the United States, which are bloated prices.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I guess I have a problem with the word pricing because doctors usually don't have prices. They're told what they're able to get reimbursed.
So well, let me
really talk. It's a reimbursement model as opposed to a pricing model.
Mr. Chair and Representative Maurer, I appreciate what you're saying. I think as we see, for example, in hospital costs, it really is a function of pricing. And as I'm referring to this, this is an area which, for example, we're quite focused on.
Right. Because I believe Medicare doesn't allow, you don't negotiate with Medicare. You don't really, you don't negotiate with Medicaid.
Tell them what you want, they'll give it to you.
They just, yeah. Okay.
Okay. In House Bill 2009, it says that the insurance exchange can cap increases in provider prices. And we believe that it actually is past time for authorizing caps and that Oregon should look at a rate setting system that would apply not just to products but also to the entire healthcare market. We believe there is not meaningful price competition in the healthcare market today, and that even with transparency and aggregating purchasers into large buying pools, that it won't change that. That we need to have evidence-based systems for setting uniform prices to be paid, whether it's by Medicaid, by private insurers, or individuals who do not have insurance. These prices, we think, should be based on costs that a provider or a facility must incur to provide services and should reward cost efficiency, good medical practices, and good patient outcomes. The second issue we wanted to focus on is modifying systems of payment so that they reward providers for doing what we want them to do and not by offering incentives that in some cases may provide a maximum or increases of margin but don't improve public health or patient health. The bill 2009 recognizes the need for payment reform and establishes a payment reform council. We have some concerns of whether that council could be an opportunity for delay rather than an impetus for action. We believe there's a lot of good work that's been done that needs to be implemented, and we need a mandate to translate that knowledge into a program for change. And it talks in the testimony about public agencies, whether it's DHS, whether it's PEB or OEB. And we believe that their ability to adopt innovative payment systems will, without doubt, encounter significant resistance, and that having a legislative mandate for change would help them be effective in this regard. The third item is that we would like the committee to take charge for planning capital investments. Healthcare planning is a community activity. We think it should not be a business activity. The Health Fund Board recognizes that hospitals and other healthcare businesses need to build facilities and expand, but that often this happens not necessarily in the interest of the community, but what's in the interest of the bottom line. We've seen lots of examples. Portland area is a good example. Cancer centers going up or heart centers because they're profitable. We don't see a race to create mental health programs or intensive care facilities. We don't see efforts to draw in Medicare, Medicaid patients. And the reality is there are too often business decisions, not healthcare decisions, being made. When half of hospital revenues in this country come from public sources, we believe the taxpayers have a right to have a voice in these decisions and that we should eliminate excesses that drive up costs. We believe that we can create venues for people to gather in the community to look at all of the medical facilities in their community as a single resource and identify what the community needs. Oregon's Certificate of Need program is one vehicle for dealing with this issue, but it applies only to construction of new facilities. And so we urge you to look at, as well, other capital investments, including the expansion of medical facilities. Fourth, we would urge you to look at reengineering healthcare delivery systems so that all healthcare workers are working at the top of their license. One of the reasons that the U.S. healthcare system is expensive is we have doctors and registered nurses who provide healthcare services in some instances that could be equally as well provided by healthcare workers who are not licensed at the level they are. And so we would urge you to look at helping to deal with the lack of coordination, inefficiency in the administration of our healthcare system, and to be cautious of scope of practice limitations that interfere with efficient redesign of healthcare services, while, of course, you know, we want to encourage innovation but not be reckless in that regard. Fifth and the final point is we would urge you to support adoption of a healthcare IT infrastructure, and that's to support high-quality, cost-effective care. When we say healthcare information technology, we're talking both about electronic medical records but also reporting systems that provide transparency. And with that, we would say that it allows for avoiding redundant or even in some cases contraindicated care by having electronic medical records. We also believe that the all-payer, all-claims data system that's proposed for Oregon would enable us to have, as community members, the ability to improve quality and save money in these four ways: better understanding disease patterns, better understanding variation in treatment modalities by comparing costs among providers, and finally giving us information that is needed to intervene when providers administer care inefficiently. So let me conclude by saying that I know you have an enormous number of policy options and considerations in Senate Bill 2009. We would encourage the committee to support these four cost containment features as critical pieces of, as you move forward. And finally, I'll just conclude by saying again, we applaud your efforts to improve access to quality, affordable health care for all Oregonians. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Dale. Mr. Chamberlain.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Tom Chamberlain. I'm president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I want to thank you for inviting us today to testify on HB 2009. It's important work that you're undertaking to ensure that the health care works for all Oregonians, especially in this time of economic downturn where more and more Oregonians are without health care. I'd like to focus today, though, on two important issues. That is the health authority and the insurance exchange. The health authority is the key to ensure reform. I was a member of the Oregon Health Fund Board. I want to be clear, I'm here testifying on behalf of the Oregon AFL-CIO, not the Oregon Health Fund Board. But as we went through that process, what I saw was a very diverse or fractured healthcare system of our state. And what the authority does is bring all those components under one tent. To me, it was the only way you can really come up with a strategic way to address healthcare problems in this state and how we move forward and expand and how we change the system. I would suggest, and we will be submitting amendments, though, that that health authority, like Senate Bill 329, needs to be a diverse board. It needs to be a board with different viewpoints. 329 ensured that we had different viewpoints as we went forward as the Oregon Health Fund Board. And I believe for us to be successful with the authority, we have to have that type of approach. As it relates to the insurance exchange, it is, I think, one of the greatest potential for change. The insurance exchange should be a force that encourages insurance companies to be more competitive. We must make sure that all plans in the exchange meet a minimum of essential benefits so that there is not a rush to the bottom to offer the cheapest insurance plan by cutting benefits to the bare minimum. We've seen that occur in other states. We must make sure that the agencies reviewing insurance premiums taking into account not just the insurance company's available reserves, but also the reason for the premium increases and the effects those increases will have on the number of people covered and the future operability of the company, among other factors, so the exchange stays efficient and affordable. Finally, there must be a public option. As one of the many plans offered through the exchange, the public option is the best way to encourage for-profit insurance companies to stay competitive through the insurance exchange to offer comprehensive coverage at affordable cost. Again, I want to thank you for inviting us here today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple questions, if I may.
I also want to thank you for your work on the health fund board. I know it was a lot of work. Yes,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Ms. Dale, one of the questions, and that actually this applies to all people that come up, is that, you know, if there was a broad-based solution for the assessment, I know you testified that you, well, not the hospitals, and from the language, it appears, you know, it just seems like, well, they're the biggest player in the room, so they must pay. But hospitals are losing money this year. My local hospital lost money last year, and it's expected they're going to lose money, and they're shedding services. A lot of the community-based services that provide support to seniors, and that's in my local community. But are the labor unions willing to be part to help pay for this assessment if there was a broad-based proposal for tax?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Maurer, I'm not sure what are you asking that would we be willing to pay for?
Well, I mean, there's essentially right now we're going to tax the insurance companies and we're going to tax the hospitals, and I'm not convinced that is going to be workable. It'd be great if we got increased reimbursement, but there's views saying transfer tax is a possibility, and that would clearly impact your constituents if we have a true, essentially a sales tax. Are you willing to go that far and help with the sales tax?
And we do not support it. The Oregon AFL-CIO does not support a transfer tax. Let's be clear. You're going to dump billions of dollars into the hospitals, billions. And you saw the same presentation I did from, I believe it was from McDonald, about how if we change the reimbursement rates, hospitals will actually do better after the change in the reimbursement rates, even with provider tax, than if we do nothing. So I hear what the hospitals are saying. I do not buy their argument. And I don't think the data, especially from McDonald, verifies that.
O'Connell,
thank you.
Okay. That wasn't really my question, but, I mean, actually, you answered the question directly, but I'm wondering if the other...
Chair Greenlick and Representative Maurer, I guess I won't speak to a specific transfer tax at this point because we've not taken a position on it organizationally. I would say this. Workers pay a cost in the healthcare system every single day. The biggest problem we have is that so many Oregonians don't have access to healthcare. Many Oregonians who have the luxury of having employer-provided healthcare and have maintained it through unionized contracts have compromised wage increases to maintain levels of benefit for a long period of time. I've said at the Health Policy Commission, and I would say here today, that workers are going to be part and always will be a part of finding a way to do their share of making sure that we have a high-quality health care system, and including sharing appropriate costs in that. There are deductibles, there are co-pays, there are other things. I would like to say with regard to the issue of margins, we have a lot of research, all of us have seen it, with regard to the margins that hospitals have had in this state for a long time. And there are hospitals that have incredibly high margins, way significantly larger, as one CEO of a hospital said to me a couple of years ago, when margins exceed X percent, it creates mischief. We had a lot of hospitals making margins in excess of that amount, and he was referring to 6%. And so, you know, I hear what you're saying. It's a difficult time for hospitals. We know that right now, because of investment income, hospitals are hurting in a lot of ways. But their margins, their operating margins, are not necessarily hurting. It doesn't mean that certain ones are not. So anyway, I respect your concern, and I would just tell you that I think workers do step to the plate. We will continue to do that, but there has to be a fair system of also not having an infusion of dollars in a healthcare system that allows excessive profits to be taken out of it by hospitals or any other providers.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thompson?
Yeah, one quick question for you, Leif. One of the parts of the equation that we keep skirting around, I'm glad to see you people here because you represent a lot of patients, is the role of the patient in all this. Now, Chairman Greenlick is going to sponsor legislation to outlaw smoking. I'm going to do a bill to put a 60-cent tax on bacon cheeseburgers, but I doubt that either one of those will address the problem of incentivizing patients toward more healthy lifestyles. Whether we like it the way it is or not, we have a relatively open access system where a lot of people are accessing health care that don't need it if they pay attention to a healthier lifestyle. How do we incentivize people to lead a healthier lifestyle and not need so much medication or health care? And I think that's something that, I mean, big groups like yours can help with. And I think there are actually data showing that a lot of the chronic use in health care is to a large number of people that just keep coming back with more symptomatic relief, where if they quit smoking, quit eating, follow their asthma regimen, whatever, they wouldn't be there. And that's costing us a huge amount of money.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Thompson, there's no question that we need to do more health promotion in this country. And there are some very good efforts being made. I mean, I'm familiar right now with Kaiser Permanente has a program, the Samaritan Health System has a program. What's interesting is that it is not a function necessarily of patients paying more in terms of cost to make it happen. It's a lot of it is around awareness. We know that there are chronic health issues that drive health care costs in this country. Five chronic health conditions in this country drive about 80% of the cost.
Yeah.
And so there is a lot we could do around health promotion. We do not have a health system in this country. We have a treating the sick system in this country, and that's one of the problems that we have. So there's a lot that could be done in that area. I would say, I'll just give you an example. We, as a union, Local 49 negotiated with Samaritan Health System to allow workers who were paying several hundred dollars out of pocket per month on premium to have a fully paid premium if they would opt into a health program, which they did. And the results have been quite remarkable. So people pay less, their health outcomes have improved. And so a lot of it is around design of program and incentives, not necessarily requiring people to pay more out of pocket to make that happen.
Skiers, you got to watch out for those adrenaline freaks. Thank you very much. While the other folks are coming up, let me just tell the committee, we're planning our meeting next Friday afternoon will be a work session on House Bill 2009 up in room 350. We're going to try and set up the room the way the Land Use Committee, which I was very impressed with, around a table so we can go over item by item by item, every section, including the proposed amendments of it. Give the committee, who's sort of behind the curve on this one, a chance to really ask questions of each other and to look at precisely what's happening.
And the public is behind us?
The public will be around us.
Wow.
We'll be in the pit.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Representative Garrett's vice chair of the Land Use Committee, I think we've had some very interesting discussions. We've been able to look at each other and talk to each other. And I hate hearing 50, but I like that model very much.
I agree.
Chair Greenlick.
Guys are the cleanup hitters.
Yeah, we are the, yes, we will close things out here quickly. And I want to make way for Ken Allen to make some comments. But Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Maurer, Vice Chair Harker, Lindsay Capps with the Oregon Education Association, I'm standing in today for Beth Ann Darby, who was predisposed with other issues but wished she could be here. I won't say a whole lot to elaborate on the expert testimony of the prior panel, but I just want to associate ourselves with their testimony and with the partnership of organizations that represent a wide cross-section of working Oregonians who are very concerned about health care and understand the important consequence of cost drivers in the system on wages and on the health of not only our families but our communities. I want to focus on one particular issue, and I promise to do it very quickly, and that is the efforts of this committee, which I think are very honorable efforts, to expand health care to children. We, as educators, see children come through our doors of our schools and into our classrooms, and we are acutely aware of the link between the health of a child and their achievement. And the efforts of this committee to expand healthcare access to children is not only a healthcare issue, it's an education issue, it's a moral issue. And I encourage your efforts to deal with the number of uninsured kids today in Oregon. I think it's about, I may be corrected by the chair, but I think about 1 in 5 of every uninsured Oregonian is a child. That's despite the fact that we have good federal programs such as SCHIP and the work through Medicaid to expand children's health access. So I will leave it at that, but encourage your efforts on behalf of Oregon's educators and our children to improve their health outcomes and reduce the disparities that we see along the lines of race and income. So thank you for your time.
I do want to make the point that it's important to have the children as a very high priority, but having their families in is also important.
Absolutely.
Because that
Absolutely.
Helps them use care. In the way
Absolutely.
Chair Greenlick, I want to thank you for inviting me. My name is Ken Allen. I'm the director of Oregon AFSCME, Council 75. We represent some 27,000 public, private employees throughout Oregon. There's 2 points I really want to make. I'm very supportive of this process. I was on the Bates-Westland Committee a couple sessions ago. We have a high degree of interest in the creation of a purchasing pool, which includes local governments. And we think that the model of success from the OWEB that you created last session is a very good model. It would go a long way right now to helping local governments get through the crisis that they're facing. And we have worked with local governments throughout the state on labor management health care committees. We've done innovative items aimed at answering Representative Thompson's questions of getting people to look at health issues, not just illness issues. And the model has worked, but we need the expansion so that all local governments can be covered under one pool and use that big purchasing power to help those local governments deal with the cost issues. The cost issues are the single most contentious issue that we deal with in negotiations, you know, at least for the last 15 or 20 years in local governments. The employers are tired of having to deal with that. We're tired of having to deal with it. The OWEB model is the right model for local governments. And so I want to encourage you to really look at trying to put that into this bill. It would be extremely helpful to the local government community and the folks we represent, some 8,000 local government workers. But I also want to put a face on who doesn't have insurance in this state. And out of our some 27,000 folks that we represent, there's about 4,000 that do not have family coverage. And it's very, I sit next to some of these people and they weep. I met a hospital worker in Hermiston, a hospital worker, a cook making $9 an hour. I get emotional about this. He wept when he told me he didn't take individual coverage from the hospital because he couldn't afford the $400 a month bill for family coverage. So because he couldn't provide the coverage for his children, he didn't even take the individual coverage. A hospital worker in the richest country in the world. We represent some 4,000 family child care providers, and this week I was with about 10 of them. And out of the 10, none of them have family insurance coverage for their children. Now, these folks in their own homes take care of our children so that we can go to work. And they take care of 8 to 12, 14 children. But they cannot afford the $1,000 a month coverage so that their children have insurance. We represent people that work in private, nonprofit group homes. They make $9 or $10 an hour taking care of disabled Oregonians. Employer provides insurance coverage. There's no way they can afford the $300 or $400 a month bill or more for the coverage of their families. So they have individual coverage. These folks are full-time, sometimes folks that are working overtime, hard-working Oregonians, and their children don't have coverage. So this is one of our top priorities, getting to the coverage of the children as a first step basis. It's incredibly important to us. It addresses cost shift issues, the uninsured that impact the rates that we have to negotiate over with our employers. So we're hugely supportive of this bill. We will do whatever it takes to help you do this. And I just want to, we have 27,000 members. Whether they're insured or not insured, they all support the idea that this is extremely important. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair. Yes,
Thanks. Mr. Chair. Ken, I appreciate your comments in general, but I'm intrigued by your comment about desire for pooling because I feel like we've been getting a very different message from representatives of the counties and cities. I think in this room, certainly in my office. And so I'm wondering, is this an ongoing subject of labor management discussions? Is there any kind of meeting of the minds on this?
Representative Dembro, through the chair. We have talked in the last 2 years in particular, we talked about creating a Portland metro area pool with the employees we represent. And the city of Portland's very interested, Multnomah County, the Port of Portland, Housing Authority of Portland, Metro Regional Government, Clackamas County sent people to meetings, other smaller cities, so that we would have the bargaining power to create, you know, better rates for our employers. We think, though, that the OWEB model is the best model to take a look at doing this statewide, because in the Portland metro area, we have reasonable medical plans and there's competition, but it's in the rural areas of the state where city and county workers and have much higher difficulty. Their employers have more difficulty providing good plans. So they could benefit in a big way. And the OWEB model is a good model for the cities and counties. I believe that most of the, at least the major players, would be supportive of this. And if necessary, we could get some local government officials to come and talk about that.
I think the underlying assumption in the Oregon Health Fund Board report is that we could ultimately get together perhaps a million lives through both public and private involvement in the exchange. And the extent to which we could do that, we could have a significant ability to move things. But it's obviously a stage thing. It's nothing that we're going to get through that quickly. Representative Maurer?
Thank you. The OWEB model is about negotiating rates for the policy rate, but still they collectively bargain at a local level.
Mm-hmm.
So their caps and however they negotiate that is a different issue. But right now, 2009, OEB and PEB sit outside. They're not included in the Oregon Health Authority. I mean, there's no comment in it. And there's been a suggestion.
I think there is comment in it, but there's not the requirement.
No, I don't even think. Well, there's PEB. But there's a conversation about bringing OEB and PEB under the Oregon Health Authority. Do you have a comment?
I'm not going to speak for OWEB because I don't represent folks there, but I'm speaking directly to trying to create the same kind of health care trust for local governments. And whether we can do it under this bill, that needs to be done. It would be extremely helpful to local governments.
You're talking about creating a pool that includes PEB and the local governments?
Well, it could include PEB, or the local governments could be standalone like OWEB, but it's a great model for state workers, PEB is. OWEB is a great model for education employees, and local governments need that model.
The question was bringing the control of PEB, because that's a separate board, OWEB, and bringing them, folding their tent under the umbrella of the Oregon Health Authority.
Yeah, we haven't taken a position on that. I think what we need to do is take a look at what PEB and OWEB have done in terms of plan design and influence in the market on health issues, wellness issues, take the best of those and put them into this model.
And OEA, since clearly you have an interest in OWEB.
I don't want to evade your question. I'm, however, not the person that deals with the OEB issue, so I would be happy to have someone answer that question for you. Right.
It is going to be one of the considerations, I think, when we look at what we're talking about and we ask the Health Authority Board to create an exchange and to figure out how to begin to pool these things. That is going to absolutely be a question, but I suspect definitively it'll be a question in the OEB. 11 in the 2011 session rather than in this session is my guess. We will be for you in the audience that are interested and you haven't received, Representative Maurer and I with Tom Burns created a document that goes section by section by section in the substantive sections of the bill and create some proposals for amendments that have gone down to the to LC. It's a pretty big document. It's available publicly. If you would contact the committee administrator for a copy of it, she'll be glad to ship it to you. And that's what Friday, I really want to make sure that everybody in the committee has a chance to really explore those, and we'll be going over that section by section to have the ability to ask questions and figure out what's there. And a way we can do it. So we won't be taking any public testimony. It'll be a work session. It'll only be us. We'll start in section one and go through section 128, skipping about 70 sections in the middle.
And we'll hit happy hour at about four.
Bring your own.
Oh, no.
I will close the informational meeting on House Bill 2009. At least five of us will be meeting down in Grants Pass at 10 o'clock. Is that Representative Maurer?
Yes, sir.
10 a.m.
And the building is?
Ambassador Auditorium, which is downtown.
And Representative Dembro, we have a little business. I don't know whether anybody's talked to you. On Monday, whether you can join us by phone at 10 for about 15 minutes.
And Cannon can join us.
Oh, Cannon can join us? Okay.
Are we going to actually have a work session?
Yes.
Well, you want to work your bill. We just need to make sure we have a quorum.
Do you want
to
gavel out and we can talk about this?
Okay. Yeah. We are adjourned.
All right. Yeah. I should be able to.